Hello and welcome to the Booktopia Buzz for the month of May. I'm Caroline Baum, and apologies if I sound a little bit nasal this month because I am battling with a cold. Can it really be May already? Where is the year going? This month's selection helps you to slam on the brakes from the rising panic that the year is accelerating out of your control. Lose yourself in the world of an enigmatic painting in the book everyone will be talking about, The Last Painting of Sarah DeVos, or treat yourself to the acerbic forecasting of Lionel Shriver's The Mandibles for a cautionary tale about financial collapse. Take Nick Earls's Gotham with you on the train or bus and turn the pain of commuting into the private pleasure of escape. Immerse yourself in other people's stories and watch your own life expand. Slow down with a book, breathe with a book. There, that's better. Okay, so straight into the book of the month, which is a novel by an Australian expat living in America, The Last Painting of Sarah DeVos by Dominic Smith. Now, any buzz you may have heard about this book is entirely justified. It is, hands down, the most polished, intelligent, utterly satisfying literary fiction of the year. It has everything: a compelling plot full of twists and turns, characters who remain intriguing to the very end, multiple locations, and a narrative split between different periods, each richly observed in the minutest telling detail. The themes, scope, and ambition of this novel are big. This is a book about art that examines authenticity from many different perspectives and angles, both on the canvas and in human nature. But while the topic is serious, the tone is often playful, and there's much mischief and fun to be had. In the world of 17th century Holland, painter Sarah DeVos has lost a daughter and embeds her sorrow in her landscapes. In modern-day New York and Sydney, collectors, curators and scholars stake their reputations on works that may or may not be any more genuine than they are themselves. Intelligent and elegantly choreographed, this is one of those novels that makes you feel smarter for reading it and manages to be both entertaining and informative. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And while we're on a high with Australian fiction, we come to Gotham from Nick Earls. Now, this is the first in a series of five novellas, and it's a wafer slim but utterly satisfying delight, an entree that feels like the main course. Way more filling than it looks, this is a marvellously observed, tautly contained vignette of the encounter between music journo Jeff Foster and his 19-year-old pop star subject Nasty Boy. They meet in a specially closed department store so that Nasty can do some luxe brand shopping in private. Awkward and uneasy, the two dance around each other with Minder Smokey, security personnel and shop assistants in attendance. There is an embarrassing moment involving a credit card. Earls knows how to pitch this sharply contemporary piece perfectly. He captures the zeitgeist, understands the facades of fame and what they hide, the insecurities of celebrity, and the dynamics that make connections so fragile and fleeting between people who are meeting for purely professional reasons. But there is tenderness and pathos here too, revealed gradually as the story builds from something seemingly slight, a celebrity encounter, to become something deeper. Smokey's wife is in labour, but he's not by her side. He's following progress on the phone. Jeff is a father too, and time with his daughter is more than normally precious, so the long, drawn-out exchange with Nasty costs him dearly. The tug between his work life and his life as a dad adds poignancy to this pocket-sized pleaser. Looking forward to the next instalment of this very, very much. Now, I always look forward to a new book from Lionel Shriver. It's no secret that she's probably one of my favourite authors. So now she's delivered The Mandibles. And despite the fact that they're called The Mandibles, this is not about anything to do with food, but there is a lot to chew on here. Lionel Shriver is in top form with her savage, fierce take on the American financial crisis. Pitched forward into a not-too-distant future, 2029, and complete with a vocabulary of new words, this is Shriver's razor-sharp cautionary tale on the financial mess an American white middle-class family, the Mandibles, gets itself into when its investments go down the toilet, the dollar collapses, and the money markets implode. As resources become scarce, the consequences for the Mandibles become more acute, putting new pressures on parents and children. Although one member of the family, the precociously smart Willing, has seen it all coming. an apocalyptic romp that skewers capitalism and fiscal policy, loaded with warnings, mocking predictions, and satirical scenarios that are alarmingly plausible. This is contemporary fiction with relevance, immediacy, and urgency. Ignore it at your peril. Now, funnily enough, by pure coincidence, an American debut novel has come out, which makes the perfect pairing with The Mandibles, if I can only get the name of the author straight. So this is The Nest by Cynthia Dapree Sweeney, which is a bit of a mouthful. Anyway, as I said, the perfect pairing with The Mandibles, this is a darkly comic portrait of another dysfunctional American family coming to terms with notions of disappearing savings and expectations of an inheritance known as The Nest. At the centre of this social comedy is Leo Plum, the charismatic older brother lawyer, fresh out of rehab after a car crash involving a 19-year-old waitress. Yep, he's having a midlife crisis, all right. Leo's accident threatens The Nest, a joint trust fund that his siblings are counting on to rescue them from their own self-inflicted mistakes, from too large mortgages to writer's block. The crisis forces them to come together and take stock of their shortcomings. It is familiar terrain, but no less juicy for that. The big themes here are family, responsibility, ambition, personal failings, and entitlement. More specifically, the paralysis induced by knowing there's a pile of money that you can fall back on if all else fails. Sweeney, who started writing in her mid-40s and got a $1 million advance for this book, her debut novel, juggles her wide cast of flawed characters with a very light, deft touch. She has sympathy for them, but is also more than willing to make fun of their expectations and foolish choices too, which makes this a very enjoyable ride. It's a very upscale New York, Brooklyn to be precise, now Yuppie Central, baby boomer, tale of privilege squandered, but way more entertaining than worthy. It's sort of like the Royal Tenenbaums meets Claire Massoud's The Emperor's Children. Now, British non-fiction. I don't know whether you remember Kate Summerscale's previous books, but she's come up with a new work of historical biography. Crime, really. Crime history biography called Wicked Boy. I'm a great fan of Summerscale's meticulous British biographies. She has such a fastidious and beady eye for detail. It's as if she's looking at all the evidence through an extra sharp microscope. She combines her methodical analysis with real writerly flair when it comes to archival material, making it come alive in Technicolor. The Queen of Whale Key, or Whale K, I'm not quite sure how you say that, is a hoot and would make a marvellous film. The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher, which is probably the book that she's best known for and won several awards, is a fascinating true crime take on the classic murder mystery, all set in an English country house. Now, Summerscale tackles the case of a teenage boy, Robert Coombs, and his younger brother, accused of the stabbing murder of their mother in 1895. The boy's actions are not really the focus of Summerscale's attention. They're not in dispute. Instead, she gives us the social canvas in which the crime is committed and, more importantly, how Robert's circumstances contributed to his mental regression. But also, more fascinatingly, following his sentencing, Summerscale takes us inside one of Britain's most famous prison asylums, Broadmoor. Robert Coombs was the youngest inmate of this famous place by several years. And strangely enough, against all the odds, it was the making of him. I won't tell you what happens next, as I don't want to spoil the suspense of the story. Suffice to say, it leads in a very unexpected direction and tells a powerful story of redemption that is moving and enlightening. And talking of moving and enlightening, we've got an Australian memoir out this month called Farewell to the Father from journalist Tim Elliott. Following from a memorable piece he wrote about his father's depression for the Good Weekend magazine, which you may remember from a couple of years ago, Elliot has now written a bravely honest memoir that fleshes out the family story and amplifies his father's history of mental illness. It begins with a disturbingly arresting scene in which the whole family is party to Tim's father's first suicide attempt, a moment of ghastly drama for 7-year-old Tim. What follows is an account written with great love and understanding and that provides tremendous insight for anyone caught up in the vortex of bipolar disorder. Now, in biography this month, we've got a book that is one of the strangest books that I've come across in a long time, called A Life Discarded by Alexander Masters. It's rare these days to come upon a book that is so genuinely eccentric that it defies categorization. Yes, this is a biography, but it is much more than that. It's also a mystery, a puzzle to be solved, and a memoir. One day, a friend of the author's finds 148 diaries in a skip and gives them to him. The diaries, written in books that vary in size, bear no name and are illustrated with funny sketches. At first, he thinks the author must be a man, but who? Going to enormous trouble to find the answers, the author becomes a journal sleuth, using all the skills he's acquired. as an experienced biographer. But a biographer knows the identity of his subject, whereas here, Masters is truly fumbling in the dark. This is a fascinating and genuinely intriguing piece of detective work, undertaken with a mixture of scholarship and fun, and written with great verve and momentum. It is, without a doubt, the quirkiest literary adventure of the year. In Australian fiction, Tony Jordan, who is a much-loved author, has a new novel out called Our Tiny Useless Hearts, kicking off with a great opening line that sets the tone for high-energy fun. This is a jaunty, tightly choreographed suburban rom-com with plenty of classical farcical scenes, men with cushions over their genitals, shimmying up balconies and hiding in bathrooms, partners both present and former turning up at the most inappropriate moments, and crisply comic dialogue. Jordan harnesses her emotional intelligence to all the comic moves to create an immensely likeable, jolly romp. Now, a book came out a month or two ago that you may have missed, so I just want to draw your attention to it because it is so very noteworthy and excellent. It's a work of American fiction called All Things Cease to Appear by Elizabeth Brundage. This is a fine, classy piece of writing that I really hope finds the audience it deserves. It's many things at once, like quite a few of the books, actually, that we're talking about this month. It's a literary thriller, a portrait of an American rural town that has gone through collapse and come through with gentrification, a beautifully calibrated story of a family that has suffered tragedy and is struggling to live with dignity, and the story of a marriage that unravels in a house that may or may not be haunted. Interweaving several narratives and characters who are never less than compelling, this story has it all. A plot with a level of page-turning whodunit intrigue, but also plenty of psychological complexity, prose that shifts seamlessly between the worlds of the living and the dead, with sharply satirical sketches punctuating more lyrical writing, creating a rich tapestry of human motives. The result is truly haunting as well as haunted. And one final reminder, of course, it's Mother's Day in May, and I've got in front of me a book that's just arrived called Daffodil, Biography of a Flower by Helen O'Neill, who wrote a book about Florence Broadhurst and also an illustrated biography of Harry Seidler. So she's pretty good at doing historical research. And what's so lovely about this book for Mother's Day is it is beautiful. It's as beautiful as a coffee table book, but it's in a smaller format. It's very handsomely illustrated, and it goes into the history of the daffodil and its many hybrids and the different ways that it's been farmed and all sorts of aspects, including the sort of philosophy and botany of horticulture. And so if you have a mother who loves flowers or loves gardening, this book is one of the handsomest gifts I can imagine giving and is going to last a lot longer than a bunch of flowers. So there you have it. That's my choice for May. Apologies for the cough in the middle. Hope you enjoy the selection and look forward to talking to you again next month.